As any ship was lamed, they shifted to another target, battering at them, trying to cripple their drives and slow them until their own Leviathans could re-secure control of the warp point or the other attack forces pursuing gunboats could overhaul. The toll of dying ships rose hideously, and Prescott clenched his fists, chained to the warp point by his orders. The faster units of the main bug formation were close enough to range on his own ships now, and his rearmed fighters launched while his starships bobbed and wove in evasive action and salvoed their own missiles. The battleship Prince George blew up in the heart of Antonov's formation, and her sister Spartiate lost a drive room and fell back, then turned to join the equally lamed super-dreadnoughts Sumatra, Kalas, and Mount Hood, and engage the enemy more closely. They could no longer escape. All they could do was make their deaths count by covering sisters who could still run, and Prescott's eyes burned as they drove into the enemy. The battlecruiser Al-Sabanthu tore apart, and Vice Admiral Tathanak died with his flagship. The CVL's Arbiter and Shangri-La, a part of Prescott's own task force for so many long months, exploded, and still the carnage went on and on. But the bugs were losing ships, too, he told himself fiercely. 5 super-dreadnoughts, and now 3 of their new monster ships were gone, and others were damaged. His own fighters arrived, tearing into the enemy, ripple-firing frams, vanishing in hateful spalls of fire as Afhawks or energy weapons or point defense snatched them out of space. Yet it was working. It was working. Hideous as Second Fleet's losses were, some of its units were breaking into the clear, running ahead of the storm, already vanishing through the warp point while Antonov personally coordinated the rear guard and TF-21 engaged the handful of faster bug ships foolhardy enough to come within its reach. Crete's flag bridge crackled and seethed with combat chatter and orders as Prescott and his staff fought to impose some sort of order on the chaos. And then... "Sir!" Prescott's head snapped up at the anguish in Jacques Bichet's voice. He looked at his ops officer, and Bichet's face was white. "Sir, Colorado's lost 3 drive rooms." Raymond Prescott felt the blood drain from his face. He spun back to his plot and saw the jagged, flashing band that indicated critical damage about the fleet flagship's icon. Somehow, even now, it seemed impossible. It had to be a mistake. Ivan Antonov was a legend. But even legends die, a small, numb corner of Prescott's brain whispered. "Recall the fighters." He didn't recognize his own voice. "Get them aboard for transit." "But, sir, the—" "Get them aboard," Prescott barked, without even turning his head. And then, "Calm, get me the flag." Even now, the range was sufficient to impose communications lags, and he waited, his heart an ice-wrapped knot, until an image stabilized on his display. He looked past Antonov's helmeted head into the anteroom of hell. Colorado's flag bridge was a depressurized shambles, littered with bodies. Bodies, Prescott was numbly certain, of men and women he'd come to know well. And one side of Antonov's vac suit was spattered with blood.
"You did well, Admiral," Antonov said quietly. "Thank you."
Prescott wanted to scream, to curse the other for thanking him. But he didn't. Instead, he forced his voice to work around the lump which seemed to strangle him.
"Sir, we can hold a little longer," he said. "Keep coming. We can get you out."
Seconds ticked past while the message sped towards Colorado, and he saw 2 more of the cripples covering Second Fleet's retreat wiped from his display before Antonov replied.
"Negative, Admiral Prescott," he said almost calmly. "You are now Second Fleet's commander, and your responsibility is to your people. Recover your fighters and make transit."
His eyes stared into Prescott's for a moment, and then he said very softly,
"You can do no more here, Raymond. All you can do is get the rest of our people home. I count on you for that."
The screen went blank as Antonov cut the circuit, and Raymond Prescott bowed his head.
"We can't recover all the fighters before the bugs get here, sir," Jacques Bichet said. "Over 60 are too far out to reach us in time."
"We'll have to leave them," Prescott said drearily.
"But I said we'll have to leave them."
Prescott interrupted Bichet's sharp protest, and his voice was so flat with pain, the ops officer closed his mouth with a snap. Prescott felt Bichet's presence, but he couldn't take his eyes from the plot. Not even when his carriers flashed through the warp point, or when his battle cruisers followed. Not even when his own flagship headed into the warp point. He stared into it, watching the last abandoned units of Second Fleet's rear guard and their tattered umbrella of dying fighters as the pursuing bugs closed for the kill. The last thing Raymond Prescott saw before Crete vanished into the warp point herself was TFNS Colorado, her weapons destroyed, her broken hull trailing atmosphere and water vapor and debris, but no life pods, never a life pod, as she redlined her surviving engines and disappeared in an eye-tearing boil of light as she rammed one of those new monster ships head-on. Chapter 41. The Road Home. The enemy had escaped. It was not possible, yet he had. The fleet had paid heavily to bait the trap, to close it behind him, to draw him in and expose his core systems to counterattack. And still, almost half his warships had escaped. Attack Force 4 turned vengefully on the handful of cripples which remained in the system. The enemy's lamed vessels were no more than wrecks, yet they fought to the last. And when their final weapons were gone, they closed in agonizingly slow ramming attempts. Few succeeded, but each of those who did took yet another starship with it, and so the fleet stood off and smashed the final units with missile and energy fire. But when the last died, the fleet's quandary remained. The plan had called for the enemy to perish here, and he had not. A review of the tactical data indicated that most of his escapees were damaged, many critically, and his losses in attack craft had been even heavier, proportionately, than in starships. Yet those starships remained faster than the fleet's battle line, else they had not escaped at all. The handful of new, fast battle cruisers might be able to overtake, as could the light cruisers of the other attack forces, once they reached the warp point. But by that time, the enemy's capital ships would have had many hours to make emergency repairs. Super dreadnoughts, even damaged, would be more than a match for such light units, and if the enemy had detached yet another sacrificial rear guard to cover the warp point, the fleet's starships would pay a hideous price to pursue him. Yet there might still be an answer. The gunboats of Attack Force 1 were barely 25 minutes from the warp point, with those of Attack Force 2 only an hour behind. If Attack Force 4's survivors took those gunboats under command, they could be thrown through the warp point in a single wave 1,400 strong. The enemy's decimated attack craft could not stop such a mighty force, and gunboats had the speed to run down any starship. The decision was made, and Attack Force 4 closed on the warp point, licking its wounds and reorganizing its shattered data groups while it awaited the gunboats. Crete emerged from the warp point. Too much grief and heartache filled her flag bridge to permit of any sense of elation, but Raymond Prescott dragged himself up from the depths of his own despair. In 10 days, no, in 12 hours, he'd gone from Second Fleet's most junior task force CO to its commander-in-chief. That terrible responsibility was his now, and he felt it grinding down upon him. "How many fighters made it out, Jack?" His voice was quiet, but Bichet flinched. Prescott had no idea how much grief had leaked through his self-control, and the ops officer cleared his throat.
"I am not certain, sir. Captain Kincaid made it. It looks like she's Farshad Kanak for the fleet now. But I'm not even sure how many of the carriers got out. I'm trying to get reports now, but the rest of the fleet's command structure is shot to hell, sir."
"How many aboard our carriers?" Prescott pressed.
"I make it 200, sir," Bichet said softly. "Roughly."
Prescott winced, then drew a deep breath.
"Relaunch half of them immediately. I want them on the warp point as an anti-gunboat CSP. Rearm the other half with FM3s, if we still have enough. Each strike group will have 15 minutes to reorganize its own squadrons. Then I want them in space again. As soon as they launch, recall the first half to rearm and reorganize."
Bichet nodded, and Prescott turned to his chief of staff.
"Anna, your job is to find out what's left of the other task forces.
I want a head count. I want to know exactly what munitions and weapons everyone has. Sandy, he switched to Ruiz, I want a complete inventory of what we have left, too. Work with Anna and give me a complete picture of the entire fleet ASAP. The logistics officer nodded, and Prescott turned back to Mandagala. Get me that info fast, Anna, he said with quiet urgency. The bugs will be after us any minute, and I need to know what I have left to fight with.
Yes, sir. Mandagala's ebon face was grim. What about battlegroup reorganization?
That'll have to wait until we know what we've got. Jacques, the ops officer looked up from his console at his name. For right now, assume whatever TF-21 has left is all we've got. You're authorized to reorganize battlegroups as you see fit. We'll fine-tune your OBs later, if we get the chance.
Aye, aye, sir,
Bichet replied, and Prescott turned back to his plot as his staff dived into the frantic effort of discovering how much of Second Fleet had survived. He already knew the numbers were going to be bad. The last gunboat had finally arrived. Attack Force 4 spent several more minutes rechecking its new battlegroups. Over half its ships had been destroyed, and another 10% were too damaged to be committed. But it remained a powerful force, and far closer to intact than its enemies could possibly be. It was time.
"Gunboats making transit!" Crete's tactical officer snapped.
Prescott's raised hand interrupted Captain Mandagala's report as he wheeled back to the plot. Icons already spangled it, but the bugs had given him 81 priceless minutes. Every surviving fighter, 371 of them, barely 30% of Second Fleet's original fighter strength, had been rearmed and stationed directly atop the warp point. TF-21's carriers' combined magazines had retained only 206 FM-3s. They were mounted aboard 103 fighters. The others had been fitted with 3 additional laser packs and 1 life support pod each. Most of those flight crews were exhausted, and every squadron was a scratch-built, jury-rigged improvisation. They were far, far below their usual standards of effectiveness, but they were also waiting in ambush. The gunboats blinked into existence, and the fighters tore into them like demons. Missiles brushed past transit-addled point defense, and the rest of the fighters screamed in with their massive external laser armaments. They killed almost 400 gunboats in their first pass, and another 70 before the bug's systems restabilized, but that left almost 1,000. The fighter jocks wanted to loop back yet again, but Prescott's orders to Captain Kincaid had been both clear and non-discretionary. She broke off, using her superior speed to draw clear and streaked after the rest of Second Fleet. Prescott watched them come, and his heart was cold. They'd done better than he dared hope, and lost only 23 of their own to do it, but the gunboat force was far stronger than expected. He'd had time for a brief conference with Antonov's exhausted battlegroup COs, and after the enormous hard kills Second Fleet had scored, it had seemed impossible for even bugs to have that much left. But they did, and it was coming straight for him.
"All right, Jack, go to Ivan too," he said flatly.
"Aye, aye, sir."
Bichet's orders went out, and TF-21, supported by all the rest of Second Fleet's combat-capable super-dreadnoughts and battleships, all 12 of them, dropped further astern of the other survivors. None of those ships' crews expected to survive the next hour. But that wasn't their job. All they were supposed to do, all they could hope to do, with their depleted magazines and battle damage, was throw up a roadblock. When the fighters reached them, half would peel off to support them, the rest would continue to the fleeing carriers to provide the survivors with whatever failed protection they could after the roadblock died. But Raymond Prescott knew one thing with absolute certainty. If he could draw the bugs down on his command, few of them would survive his last fight to go after his cripples.
"Enemy ETA 47 minutes, Bichet announced quietly, and Prescott nodded.
"Anna, contact Admiral Mosby. I know her. Make absolutely certain that she understands she is not, under any circumstances, to send the other fighters back into this." The gunboats recognized what the enemy intended, but they were willing to accept his sacrificial gambit, even at the price of their own destruction, for those had to be his last combat-capable units. With them gone, there would be nothing to prevent the other attack forces, new, fast battlecruisers, from overhauling and smashing his wounded ships on their long road home.
ETA 20 minutes, Bichet announced. Prescott nodded acknowledgement without looking away from the plot.
At least it won't take long against this many of them, he thought. I wonder...
Sir, Admiral Prescott!
The sudden shout jerked his attention to his comm officer, and his eyebrows flew up as he saw the wild exultation transfiguring Commander Hale's face.
Sky Marshal Avram, she blurted. Sky Marshal Avram is on the priority channel.
Hannah Avram's heart twisted as her cloaked starship streaked past the first staggering broken wrecks. She could feel the agonized exhaustion with which those ships clawed towards home. Second Fleet hadn't been defeated. It had been shattered, yet its survivors fought on, and she remembered Second Lorelei. This was the second time she'd seen the wreckage of a Terran fleet, and heartbreak warred with pride as she watched that wreckage which had refused to die.
"I have Admiral Prescott, sir," her comm officer said.
"Prescott?"
"Yes, sir."
The comm officer sounded stunned, as if he couldn't believe his own words.
"Admiral Antonov is dead, sir."
It hit Hannah like a fist, and even through her shock, she knew it would hit every other Terran officer and all of their allies with equal ferocity. But for now, she was grateful for her shock. It kept the news from being real while she grappled with what she had to do, and she turned to her comm screen as Raymond Prescott's exhausted, harrowed face appeared upon it. "I'm coming in cloaked from your 006-009-er," she said flatly. "I have 17 super dreadnoughts, 10 battleships, 11 battle cruisers, and 12 heavy cruisers, but no carriers. Keep coming. I estimate contact in 23 minutes. Stay alive, Raymond. Keep them bunched and concentrating on you until I can hit them by surprise. But stay alive." Raymond Prescott turned away from his comm screen. "Jacques, new orders for Kincaid. All of her fighters stay with us."
"Yes, sir."
Icons shifted wildly as the fighters, which had already passed Crete, broke back towards her. The gunboats were only 16 minutes out. He had to survive for 5 minutes, and without those other fighters, he wouldn't. Minutes limped into eternity. His own sensors hadn't picked up the Sky Marshal yet, but he knew she was there, and the bugs didn't. He watched the gunboats sweeping closer. 10 minutes out. 8. 6. Kincaid's fighters smashed into them head-on, and the plot was ugly with the fireballs of dying gunboats and allied pilots. His Dunkirks began punching SBMs and capital missiles into the bugs, and the furnace roared hotter. 4 minutes. 2. Crete's missile batteries began to fire, and then the madness was upon him. TF-21 and its supporting scratch-built battle groups writhed under a tsunami of gunboats. Ships twisted and danced in wild evasion maneuvers, and the visual displays were a kaleidoscope of explosions. The battleship Timoleon was the first to die, then the super-dreadnoughts Ellesmere and Namcha Barwa. Crete's sisters Titicaca and Lake Michigan followed, then the battlecruiser Arizona and her squadron mate Moltke. But even as they were pounded to pieces, they fired back in an orgy of mutual destruction and hate. It went on and on, seconds stretching into hours and minutes into eternities, and Crete staggered again and again. Her shields were down, her armor shattered, her breached hull belching air. But somehow she lived and killed and killed and killed. And suddenly Hannah Avram was there. Her undamaged, unshaken ship slammed into the bugs like the hammer of God, and they flushed their exo-racks as they came. The gunboats had been so intent on their prey they never even saw her coming, and the fresh hurricane of fire took them totally by surprise. It was the bugs' turn to die, caught between two fires. But they, too, struck back. The super-dreadnoughts Luzon and Palawan, the SDEs Mercadari, Tasmania, and Parikutan, and the battleships San Genera and Terrible had raced all the way from Centauri to Anderson IV in just 14 days, only to die. But they accomplished their mission. The bug gunboats burned like a prairie fire, and in their ashes lay the survival of what remained of Second Fleet. Yet there was one last agonizing price for the Terran Federation Navy to pay. Even as Hannah Avram's ops officer announced success and she turned her comlink to Crete, one last flurry of gunboats evaded every weapon targeted upon them in their death runs. They salvoed their external ordnance and followed it in, tearing deep into TFNS Xingu's armored hull, and Raymond Prescott's screen went blank with terrible, sudden finality. The gunboat's destruction was final. The fleet had no idea how many enemy starships had come to their fellows' rescue, nor of how they could have avoided the blocking gunboat force which should have stopped them. But there was no point in sending battlecruisers and CLs against such heavy units without battle-line support. Courier drones were sent ahead, alerting the forces still between the enemy and home. But although the waiting gunboats might harass them, they were too weak to stop them. The trap had failed, but not completely. The enemy had been decisively crippled, and all four attack forces would pursue as rapidly as possible. The fleet would arrive on his heels, and this time it would send no mere survey force into the system from whence he had come. Chapter 42. Road with No End.
No question about it, sir, Feridun Hafezi reported with as much briskness as any of them could manage these days. They've entered the system in force this time, 14 battlecruisers.
Rear Admiral Summers nodded and looked around the haggard faces of Survey Flotilla 19 staff, the faces of people who had in all probability just been condemned to death. Irritatingly, at this moment when she had far better uses for it, her mind flew back in space and time to their fourth warp transit from Anderson 1, and she couldn't repress a wholly inappropriate smile.
Well, Feridun, remember when we just transited into that starless warp nexus, and you hoped that maybe we could go someplace where things would be more interesting?
The chief of staff grimaced.
Yes, I did, didn't I? Now I finally understand why combat veterans never seem to mind being bored.
It had been just after that, with their warp point survey of that stretch of space still in progress, when they'd become aware of the bug forces closing in behind them. Where they could have come from along this barren warp chain, and what their presence implied about the fate of Second Fleet, were questions Summers hadn't had the luxury of contemplating. Instead, she'd had to make an impossible decision. Trying to fight her way home through enemy forces of unknown size hadn't even been an option. SF-19 was no battle fleet. Forging on into the unknown on the one-in-a-million chance of finding a warp chain that doubled back to Allied space had seemed an equally preposterous alternative. But it had been the only alternative she'd had, and she had ordered the Huns to redouble their efforts to find a second warp point. They'd succeeded, just as one of the probing bug gunboats stumbled onto the cloaked Terran ships. It sounded the alarm before it died, and they'd been unable to prevent the packs of pursuing gunboats from observing them as they fled towards the newly discovered warp point. They'd emerged into the domain of a red giant that had long since incinerated any planets it might have possessed. Without even pausing for breath, Summers had ordered her Huns to spread out in a desperate quest for warp points, while the gunslingers turned at bay against the pursuers they'd known would be through the warp point close behind them. Her fighters had sent the initial wave of gunboats reeling back through the warp point. Then the real pursuit burst on them in mass, simultaneous transits of gunboats and cruisers, followed by waves of battlecruisers. Summers' combatants had battered them back through the warp point again, winning priceless time for the scout cruiser's frantic search for a warp point. TFNS Inca, which had found the way out of the last system, had repeated her feat while there was still time. Summers had ordered the flotilla toward the newly discovered warp point, but fresh bug gunboats had poured into the system just as the fighter screen she'd left behind had come to the end of its life support and begun to withdraw. A desperate dogfight had swirled across the red giant sky, and the damaged battlecruiser Kalinin, her crew evacuated, had been left behind to an attention-distracting self-immolation. But the flotilla had, in the end, managed to transit undetected, leaving behind the cooling plasma that had been the gunboats which might have pinpointed the escape hatch warp point. And Summers had been able to breathe again in the feeble light of the Type M red main sequence star into whose system they'd materialized. 10 days had passed before the bugs found their way into the new system and sent clouds of gunboats probing into it while their battlecruisers sat watchfully on the warp point. Summers's ships, in cloaked battle groups built around the Huns, had commenced a nerve-wracking game of cat and mouse as the search for yet another new warp point went on. Then, 3 days after the bugs' arrival, 4 of their gunboats blundered into Summers' carriers and freighters. Hastily launched fighters had blasted them out of space and then rendezvoused with their carriers beyond scanner range. SF-19, reprieved once more, had resumed its cloaked maneuverings. But the bugs, with their enemy's presence in the system positively confirmed, had intensified their search. And now, 3 days later, they'd been reinforced, bringing their total in-system strength to 32 battlecruisers and God knew how many gunboats. "Yes," Summers said, dragging her mind back to the staff meeting. "I believe the situation has ceased to be desperate and become serious." A couple of people smiled. "We now need to decide what changes, if any, to make in our survey procedure." She indicated the display screen. It was no holotank, but 2 dimensions were all that was required to display the orbital plane of this system's cold, worthless planets. It showed the warp point through which they'd entered and on which the bug battlecruisers now squatted sullenly, 120 light-minutes out from the Red Star on a bearing about 30 degrees east of the display's arbitrary north. Other icons showed the elements into which SF-19 had been divided, probing in regions closer to the system primary. "The floor is now open to suggestions. Yes, Feridun?" The chief of staff cleared his throat. "Admiral, in my considered judgment, the arrival of more bug battlecruisers lends added force to the argument I've made before." "In private," Summers mentally interjected. Now it seemed he'd decided to go public. "Why is that?" she asked aloud. "Operating in the inner system, so close to our entry warp point, maximizes our vulnerability to detection by the battlecruisers there. The presence of additional battlecruisers makes the risk we're running an even more unacceptable one." Summers decided not to make an issue of Hafezi's arguably improper use of the word unacceptable. "You're aware of the basis for my orders?"
"Yes, sir. You're firmly convinced that the warp point we're looking for is a Type 7, all known examples of which occur within 90 light-minutes of their system primaries." Hafezi drew a deep breath. "Admiral, I have utmost respect for the extensive survey experience on which you base this hunch, but I must point out that only 9% of all open warp points are Type 7s, and all the other 91% are located at greater distances from their primaries, usually at considerably greater distances. I therefore recommend that we discontinue our inner system survey and turn our attention to the outer system, where the probability of finding a warp point is 11 times greater, and where we can perform survey operations beyond the enemy battlecruiser's sensor range." Summers restrained an angry retort. She had opened the floor to suggestions, and Hafezi hadn't quite strayed over the line into insubordination. "There's something in what you say, Commodore, but I would remind you that the bugs, presumably following the same line of logic as yourself, have sent their gunboats to the system's outer limits and begun a gradual inward sweep. And while gunboat sensors aren't as powerful as those of battlecruisers, there are a lot more of them." She held the chief of staff's eyes. "At any rate, that is all secondary. The central point is that the region we're in now is the place to find a Type 7, and that in my considered judgment is precisely what we're looking for." Hafezi's eyes didn't waver. "I respectfully disagree, sir." They continued to lock eyes while the rest of the staffers tried to be inconspicuous, and Summers wondered why the chief of staff was so determined to make this a contest of wills. "Could it be," came the unwelcome question, "because I'm a woman?" Feridun came from a tradition of educated cosmopolitanism. Serving under a Westerner wouldn't gall him. But a woman? It wasn't even that she was a Western woman. There was a strain in Islam which had always equated Western woman with whore. But he'd no more have any truck with that than Summers would with the trashier elements of the West's past. Indeed, an Islamic woman might actually have been worse,
summoning up from his mental background certain assumptions about the proper roles of the sexes that not even his austere and intellectualized form of Islam had ever entirely exercised. But none of that mattered, for Summers was in command, and she had to stay there if they were to have any hope, however forlorn, of survival. Attempts to command by committee, or COs who waffled when decision time came, were a prescription for disaster Aileen Summers had no intention of following. And, she thought grimly, given that a Type 7 is our only real chance to get out of this system alive, I'm not about to debate logic versus instinct with anyone. Your objection is noted, Commodore, and you may have it on record in any form you wish. Nevertheless, we will continue to conduct our survey as per my orders. Is that clear? Summers' final question was not just for Hafezi, for her eyes swept over the entire staff. Only one other pair of eyes wavered under that regard. Commander Arabella Maningo, the logistics officer, looked left and right as though searching for something that wasn't there. When she spoke, her voice was at first quiet to the point of inaudibility, and level to the point of expressionlessness, only gradually taking on a high quaver.
What does any of this matter? Even if we do find a warp point and get through it, we'll just be one more system further away from home. And then we'll have to find another warp point, and then another, on and on, forever. And eventually our ships will wear out and our life systems will degrade.
That will do! The bullwhip crack in Summer's voice brought Maningo's head jerking up, eyes blinking, and the fog of incipient hysteria in the compartment seemed to dissipate. I know that pressing on into the unknown is a bleak option, but it happens to be the only option we've got, and it's not hopeless. Remember, the Federation and its allies comprise one hell of a lot of warp nexi, and it's not at all out of the question that we'll happen onto one of them, and we're equipped for long-term independent operations. Our maintenance resources won't give out any time soon, assuming that you manage to do your job. Maningo's eyes flashed and her jaw clenched. Good, Summers thought. Better anger than the lugubrious despair that would overtake them if they let the nightmare vision of suffocating in their own wastes, lost in an infinity of cold, dark emptiness, take up residence in their heads. She found herself half wishing that the bugs would find them. This waiting was killing them as dead as combat could, and taking longer about it. She shook the thought away and met all their eyes again. We will continue to pursue whatever avenue holds out any hope of survival. That is our minimal obligation to our personnel. Giving up is not an option we are permitted. She made sure none of those eyes met hers, either in defiance or with a mute plea to let them all lie down and die, before she adjourned the meeting. The bugs found them midway into the second watch of the following day. Summers and Hafezi were both on the flag bridge, maintaining a mutual politeness which was brittle in its frigidity, when the sensors erupted in electronic panic. A dozen gunboats sweeping out of the blackness into close sensor range of Jamaica's own battle group. They were also within missile range of the group's two battlecruisers. Get them, Summers snapped, as the gunboats turned tightly to escape with their news. But missiles were already arrowing forth from Jamaica and Roma, as per standing orders. Nine were blasted apart, yet three got beyond the missiles' reach. Summers and Hafezi looked at each other wordlessly, all differences forgotten. By unspoken consent, they turned to the system display in which the four tiny battle groups and the skulking cluster of carriers and freighters swam. Of course, there'd be no change in bug dispositions yet, but as soon as those surviving gunboats' messages could speed across the light minutes, she stared for a moment at the icon that represented her own little battle group. In addition to the battle cruisers, she had the Hun-class scout cruiser Uzbek and the CLE Marblehead, and then turned to Hafezi. Feridun, I want the battle group to proceed on this course. She used her remote, and a string light grew in the holotank. Away from the others, sir? That's right. We're the only ones whose location the bugs know. I want to draw them away from the rest of the flotilla. We'd stand a better chance of defending ourselves if we joined forces, sir, especially with the carriers negative. Even combined, we wouldn't stand a chance against the bug forces in this system. No, the other group's best defense is invisibility, which means, among other things, that the carriers are not to launch their fighters, in support of us or for any other reason. It would maximize the bug's chances of detecting them, and their lack of a command ship to data link their point defense makes them peculiarly vulnerable. She gave the chief of staff a hard look. Carry out your orders, Commodore.
Aye, aye, sir, Hafezi said, without a perceptible pause.
Jamaica's battle group swung into its new course, and as the minutes crept by, the scarlet lights of incoming gunboats began to pop into existence on Summer's plot, like a rash breaking out.
No way, she thought. They've got us. No self-deception, and no searching Feridun's face for reproach.
She straightened her back and gazed at the viewscreen on which the approaching death was, of course, not to be seen.
At least the others will have more time for a search. It's still not impossible that some of them could—
Admiral, the voice from the comm station was almost unseemly in its loudness. Priority signal from Themis! They found it, sir!
Found it? Found what?
Summers blinked away her oppressively dark thoughts and fought to shift mental gears.
A warp point, sir! A Type 7, located— Well, they're downloading it now, sir.
In the holotank, to the east-northeast of the primary star, at a distance of about 60 light-minutes from it, the icon of a warp point winked into life like the electric signpost of a doorway out of hell.
Admiral, you were right.
It never for an instant occurred to Summers to suspect Hafezi of brown-nosing. There was nothing in his face but relief and unaffected congratulation.
We can turn around and make it out before any of the gunboats reach us.
No. Summers' quiet monosyllable wiped the chief of staff's face clean of every expression but bewilderment. Our other groups are all closer to it than we are, and we have no knowledge of the bug's strength in their vicinity. She shook her head.
No, we'll continue to try to draw the bugs after us.
Order all other elements of the flotilla to clear the system ASAP. For a moment that stretched, Hafezi stared at her. Then he spoke levelly.
Admiral, have you considered the effect this order will have on our personnel's morale? There's no way we can keep the rumor from circulating through this ship that a warp point's been found, and that I'm slamming that doorway out of hell shut in their faces.
She forced herself to smile.
Feridun, you've been a naval officer long enough to know that the only antidote to rumor is forthrightness, although her familiar imp reminded her some officers never learned it.
I'll address the crew and have it patched through to the other three ships. I'll tell them the situation and explain to them that this is the way to maximize the chance of survival for some of our people, and it is therefore our duty.
With great respect, Admiral, are you sure it's our duty? Are you certain this doesn't go just a little beyond it? Is it possible that you're trying to prove something?
I'll ignore that last question, Commodore. But as to the nature of our duty, yes, this is my interpretation of it. And my interpretation is the one that counts, isn't it?
Of course, Admiral. I'll give the necessary orders.
Hafezi turned to go, then paused and faced her, and a smile flashed in the beard he'd managed through everything to keep as precisely sculpted as ever. She recalled the prophet's admonition to the faithful to grow beards so as not to be mistaken for Romans, but to trim them so as not to be mistaken for Jews.
By the way, I meant it. You were right, and I was wrong, and those who do get out of this will owe their lives entirely to you.
Then he was gone before she could think of a response. The battle groups led by Themis and Belvedere had transited the newly discovered warp point, and both times Jamaica had rung with cheering that had promptly subsided as they'd all gone back to awaiting the approaching gunboats. Finally, the red and green icons crawled together in the holotank, and time seemed to accelerate. 20-odd gunboats swept in from the blackness, sprinkling the battle group with missile fire that point defense could deal with. Then they came on through a storm of second-generation close assault missiles, seeking self-immolation. Three of them survived long enough to find it. A starship's first line of defense against collisions, intended and otherwise, is its electromagnetic shields. Its second line of defense is its space-distorting drive field, without which any physical impact at such velocities would be totally and spectacularly fatal. It is only after both of these are overloaded that the occupants are affected in any way, for any violence, however horrific, that expends itself against them has no physical medium through which to transmit shockwaves to the ship itself. Thus, Summers, Hafezi, and the rest of the flag bridge's complement sat in their cocooning shock frames and felt no concussion as the gunboat that had approached far too swiftly to be seen was consumed. They also saw nothing, for the view screen went black at the moment of impact. When it came back on, a few bits of still white-hot debris could briefly be glimpsed as they spun away and were swallowed by infinity.
"Roma got two kamikazes, sir," Hafezi reported. "Fortunately, there was an interval between them, and there was no physical damage. A near thing, though. She took a lot more shield overload than we did."
"Tell them to get the shields restored as quickly as possible," Summers ordered. "Same goes for this ship. The next wave," she waved at the plot, "isn't going to be nearly as easy." Hafezi moved away, but he was intercepted by the duty comm rating. In a quiet voice, he'd had words with them about blurting things out. He turned back to Summers with a frown.
"Admiral, we've gotten a signal from Captain Kabilovic. They've detected a bug gunboat force vectoring in on the carriers and freighters.
In light of the overwhelming probability that they've been detected, he's asking for permission to launch his fighters." She had to smile. "Yes, that's the way Milos would put it. Permission granted, of course." She sighed deeply.
"Well, Feridun, there's no further point in trying to draw the bugs off them, is there?
Get us headed for the warp point at max. We'll rendezvous with Milos on our way." For an absurd instant, Hafezi actually looked embarrassed by the fact that the course of action he'd recommended had turned out to be the only viable one. But it only lasted an instant. Then he was off, and Summers was left looking at the holotank in which the bug battlecruiser formations at the entry warp point had moved off-station and proceeded to intercept this newly detected group of prey. Even Hafezi was looking a little disheveled. He'd developed a nervous habit of running his fingers through his beard as they approached their rendezvous with the carriers. It had been a terrifying chase. For a while it had looked as though the battle cruisers that had been pursuing them, faster than bug battle cruisers had a right to move, would be able to swerve aside and intercept the carriers at a time when the fighters were otherwise occupied. But then the third survey battle group, led by TFNS Imperieuse, struggling to reach the warp point, had maneuvered into the bugs' blind zone and given them a serious load of missiles up the ass. The subsequent degradation in bug fire control suggested that they'd gotten the command ship. Something had to go right every now and then, and then the subsequent demolition of the unreasonably fast battlecruisers had followed as a matter of course. Stung, the bugs had diverted their available gunboats to the new threat, and TFNS Kai Duilio had vanished in multiple fireballs of kamikaze attacks. But Summers had used the time that had been won and was now coming into datalink range of the carriers. "Incoming gunboats!" With practiced precision, they all flung themselves into their command chairs and locked their shock frames. Summers and Hafezi had a chance to make quick eye contact before the flood of data and horror flowed over them. The gunboats were barely even bothering with extended-range missile fire anymore. With nightmarish persistence, they sought out ramming targets, and this time they came in a wave that swamped the little battlegroup's defenses. With almost physical pain, Summers watched the readouts that told of Uzbek's cataclysmic destruction, of damage to Roma and Marblehead, of one course after another of Jamaica's own shields giving up in showers of sparks and clouds of acrid smoke as their generators overloaded.
"Incoming!"
As though struck by a war god's hammer, Jamaica shuddered as a gunboat's death agony smashed down the last of her shields and rended hull metal. Summers barely heard the apocalyptic noise, for her vision began to dim as she was whiplashed back and forth within the life-saving confines of her shock frame. Then came another hammer stroke, and another, and another. Her next awareness was of shouting that seemed to come from a great distance. She shook her head to clear it, tasting the brassy tang of blood. Vision returned, and she found that the shouts hadn't been coming from so far away after all. In fact, Hafeze's face was only a few inches from hers, and those of the medics crowding in behind him weren't much further. At first she thought the ship was still shuddering, but it was only Hafezi shaking her.
"Aileen, Admiral, are you all right?"
"Why does he look so frantic?" she wondered with a small fraction of her returning consciousness. Most of it took in the fact that she was still on Jamaica's flag bridge, a flag bridge that was still functioning. The next fact to register was that Hafez's faceplate was open, as was hers, so they had air. She tried to sit up and found she had to shake her head again.
Yes, I'm all right. What about the ship?
Damage control has things in hand, Hafez reported. She wondered why he looked weak with relief and decided it must be because the ship had come through.
Most of our internal systems are all right, and the rest will be soon, but we haven't much in the way of armor integrity left. And the others?
You know about Uzbek. Marblehead isn't much better off. She's got one engine room left, but not much else. Roma is in about the same condition as we are. Summers struggled upright and waved away the medics.
We won't survive the next wave, she muttered.
She forced her brain to think and her voice to firm up.
I see we've got a little time left before the next wave's ETA. Let's use it.
I want to incorporate the carriers into this ship's data group. We can use their point defense. That's our first priority.
Aye, aye, sir, but, Admiral, you need to let them take you to sick bay and have a look at you.
No time. Now our second priority is to get Marblehead survivors evacuated. Send our small craft and Romas. What's the status of the fighter groups?
Staghound squadrons are back aboard the carrier, rearming. The same goes for most of the Ofuyuki. But two of their squadrons got through to Imperius and her battle group. That's why three of those ships still live, although Imperius is badly damaged. The Ofuyuki are still there.
Good. Signal Imperius and order them to make a beeline for the warp point.
Move.
She stood up and smiled at Hafez and the hovering medics.
See, I'm fine.
They departed, still looking dubious. It was only then that she carefully lowered herself back down into the command chair and closed her eyes to shut out the swirling universe.
The situation was somewhat frustrating. Half the fleet's available gunboat strength was still in the system's outer reaches and could not arrive in time to be a factor. And after suffering that costly surprise, the battlecruisers would be kept together, which meant the new fast ones wouldn't be able to take advantage of their speed, and that would take the formation a long time to bring the enemy within missile range. But did they have that time? The enemy had obviously discovered a warp point. His headlong flight could have no other destination. But where was that warp point? There would be no way of knowing until the enemy ships began to vanish. So there was no time to organize the gunboats into a single overwhelming wave. The scattered elements must continue to make piecemeal attacks. Even if they couldn't destroy the enemy before he made transit, they must at all costs stay in contact so as to observe that transit.
Nuremberg is Code Omega, sir.
Summers nodded absently, her soul as dulled to pain as her body had become after the repeated kamikaze impacts that had begun to tear Jamaica's vitals. The flagship couldn't complain. Roma had taken even worse damage. But the chase was coming to an end, the temporary sort of end that was the only kind that seemed possible for them anymore.
Boise has transited, sir, Hafez reported quietly.
Summers nodded again. She couldn't bring herself to rejoice. They'd made it to another warp point, true, but the bugs would follow them, for they would pinpoint that warp point from her ship's transits, so it would be the same all over again in yet another system. She straightened.
Get the carriers through as soon as possible. The battle cruisers will form a rear guard. Jamaica will, of course, be the last to transit.
Aye, aye, sir.
Roma died just short of the warp point. So did the freighter Voyager, despite everything the battlecruisers could do to shield her.
But then the last battered half-wreck was through, and Jamaica was coming up on the hole in space-time through which she would sail into...
What?
Hafez turned to face her. You did it, Admiral. You got us out of this system.
No one else was in earshot, and she finally let bitterness enter her voice.
Yes, for what?
She indicated the plot with the swarming red icons that would follow them through the warp point.
Hafez shook his head.
It doesn't matter, Eline. You did your duty, and a good deal more besides.
His eyes held hers, and he reached out a hand and gripped hers, hard, in a motion that his body shielded from all eyes on the flag bridge.
She returned the pressure, wordlessly, because there were no words, and smiled tremulously at him.
Stand by for transit. Their hands were still clasped as TFNS Jamaica vanished from the system of the Red Sun. Chapter 43.
I wish I could spare more. I'm afraid that's it, Ellen, Oscar Peterson said wearily.
He ran a hand through his hair and leaned back in his chair aboard Skywatch 1, gazing into the system schematic displayed above his desk. It was littered with the wildly scrambled icons of Fortress Command units, and Ellen McGregor sat in the flag briefing room of TFNS Amaretsu, studying its twin from the other end of their conference link.
I wish I could spare more, he went on, but if it comes apart on you, I'll need everything I've got just to fend them off Nova Terra and Eden, not to mention this side of the gateway.
I understand, Oscar, McGregor replied in a sympathetic tone. It was a bit hard, just at the moment, to sympathize with anyone but herself, but she didn't envy Peterson a bit.
They held the same rank, but he was Fortress Command while she was Battlefleet, and that gave her command authority in Centauri until Hannah Avram's return. If she ordered him to give up still more fortresses, he'd have no recourse but to obey, and part of her wanted to do just that, especially since she was busy leaving the system at the moment with every warship she could scrape up. She was also leaving the warp point mother naked in her absence. But if she didn't take those ships forward into Anderson II, the gunboats on that system's warp point to Anderson III would have a field day against Second Fleet survivors. Uncovering Centauri didn't make her any happier than it made Peterson, but the very fact that she was leaving only gave added point to his responsibility for all of Centauri, not just the Anderson II warp point, in her absence, and she refused to second-guess his dispositions.
It ought to be enough, she told him now, lips pursed as she continued her study of the schematic.
Alpha Centauri was the second most heavily fortified system in human-held space, with powerful fortress shells and minefields on each of its 11 open warp points. Fortress Command had begun assembling fresh forts to cover the system's newly discovered 12th warp point, even before Second Fleet's departure, and a potent shell of 18 fortresses had been borrowed from the other warp points to cover it while its own OWPs were built. Peterson had personally overseen both the sighting of the forts and the beginning of the new minefields, and since the new warp point was a closed one, he'd been able to emplace the mines directly atop it. That would deny an attack any clear zone into which it might transit. And he'd ringed the mines with independently deployed energy platforms, including both laser buoys and primary beam platforms, for good measure. With that backing, McGregor had felt thoroughly confident of even her badly understrength Fourth Fleet's ability to guarantee Centauri's security in Second Fleet's rear. But that was the critical point. She'd expected to cover Second Fleet's rear, and like everyone else, she'd thought she had months to perfect her defenses. Second Fleet was driving the bugs back, after all, and even if the enemy managed to mount a counterattack, Ivan Antonov's warships would be between him and Centauri. At the very least, Antonov would be able to slow him down and buy time for McGregor and Peterson to dig in behind him. That comfortable assumption no longer applied, and Peterson had every mine layer in the system employed in the frantic placement of more mines and platforms. It was going slower than McGregor would have liked. Of course, she thought wryly, it couldn't go fast enough to make me happy. But that wasn't because the weapons weren't available. Mines and energy platforms were being produced at a staggering rate by the system's spaceborne industry, and even if they hadn't been, she and Peterson could have raided the other warp points' long-established defenses for them. No, the problem was that there were only so many mine layers, and their crews, however skilled, could physically position weapons only so quickly. They were working till they dropped, but the mine densities needed to blunt a bug attack simply couldn't be built up overnight. Which was why she was having this conference. Peterson and his staff had stripped 10 of Centauri's 11 open warp points of virtually all their OWPs, and commandeered every available tug in Centauri and Sol to reposition those forts. Both he and McGregor were aware that the Grand Alliance was straining every nerve to reinforce Fourth Fleet, And even if MacGregor lost control of the outer system, the forces rushing back toward Centauri would almost certainly regain it in time. But it was Oscar Peterson's job to see to it that there were still live humans on this system's planets when that time came, not to mention his responsibility to protect Centauri's mammoth orbital industrial infrastructure and provide the maximum possible cover for the gateway. Humanity's home system was even more heavily fortified than Centauri. But Centauri was Sol's buffer and glacis. That had been the bedrock of the TFN strategic planning ever since there'd been a Federation Navy. And that, and Peterson's local concerns here in Centauri, had governed his proposed OWP redistribution. The majority were bound for positions around the system's twin planets to bolster Skywatch 1 and the other orbiting space stations. Those not headed there had been divided equally between the gateway and the closed warp point beyond which Hannah Avram's relief force was, must be, leading Ivan Antonov's survivors towards safety. Once they were all in position, MacGregor would have 70 fortresses, with something like 1,000 fighters embarked, to bar the bug's passage into Centauri. And a damn good thing, too, she thought mordantly. "'Cause I sure as hell don't have anything else to do the job with.' She grimaced at the familiar thought. The Federation was enormous, and ships took months to travel from its core to its borders. Those vast distances had always spread the TFN far thinner than raw hull numbers might suggest to the layman, for a starship could be in only one place at a time, and that simple fact was the crux of Ellen MacGregor's problem. Home Fleet, as the biggest single concentration of Terran warships, had been heavily raided in the war's opening phases. As every available forward-deployed unit had been rushed towards threatened sectors, the Romulus Cluster originally, and then Cleon, Home Fleet units had been redeployed to fill the vacuum created by their departure. Then the need to build up nodal reaction forces throughout Allied space had put still more strain on the Alliance's navies, and once again Home Fleet had been tapped to help make up the required numbers. MacGregor understood the logic behind that. Given Sol's position at the very core of the Federation, it had certainly seemed as unthreatened as any star system was likely to be, and the needed ships had to come from somewhere. But then the bugs had stumbled into Centauri, and Operation Pest House had been mounted from Centauri 10 months before it was scheduled to kick off from Zephyrane. Half the units originally earmarked for Second Fleet had already been en route to Zephyrane, so the cupboard had been bare when GHQ started looking around for the muscle Pest House required, and its eye had fallen yet again on Home Fleet. All of which meant that at this moment, Ellen MacGregor had precisely 47 starships, headed by only 6 super dreadnoughts, 9 battleships, and Home Fleet's last 11 carriers and assault carriers, to support those 70 OWPs. More were coming as fast and hard as they could, but they weren't here yet, and she didn't even know precisely how many were on their way. And however many there might be, neither they nor the forts nor the minefields were on the warp point now. She shook herself and produced a crooked half-smile for Peterson's benefit. "It ought to be enough," she repeated, "and it damn well better be, hadn't it?" The attack force's courier drones confused the blocking force gunboats, for they clearly suggested that the enemy had somehow gotten a relief force through the warp point the gunboats were charged to block. Surely that was impossible. The attacks on the enemy's support echelon had put the blocking force behind schedule, true, but not enough for that. Unless, of course, the fleet had misjudged the enemy's initial deployments. The fleet had been unable to scout the intervening systems before attacking, after all. It was possible that the enemy's relief force had actually been a routine reinforcement echelon, which had already passed through the blocking force's system of responsibility en route to the front when the trap was sprung, and the fact that it had included none of the attack craft motherships made that seem even more likely. But whatever had happened, the courier drones had reached the blocking force well before the enemy's survivors, and this time the gunboats would be waiting. Captain Jeremiah Dillinger, MacGregor's chief of staff, and Commander Fahd Aburish, her operations officer, flanked her as she gazed at the holographic representation of Anderson II in CIC's holosphere. The icons representing Amaretsu and the core of Fourth Fleet's limited striking power floated in the sphere, and MacGregor felt her staffer's unhappiness, especially Aburish's, at being here. She couldn't blame them, yet she saw no alternative to her deployment. So far, the enemy appeared not to have entered this system.